Ever since November of 2016, election night or slightly thereafter, you've been hearing about the resistance. Millions of Americans did not want or expect Donald Trump to be president and have continued to make their feelings known with their voices, with their physical presence, with their votes, and now in book form. Many creative people joined together to express themselves in prose, in poetry, and in drawings in the book Who Will Speak for America? The whole project was drawn together by a pair of editors, Stephanie Feldman and our guest, Nathaniel Popkin. Nathaniel is a historian and a novelist, the author of the recent Everything is Borrowed. His nonfiction works include co-authorship of last year's Philadelphia, Finding the Hidden City, and he's a critic many times over of other works as well. Nathaniel Popkin, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Hi, Jeff. Great to be here.
So Who Will Speak for America? Was the creation of this pretty much ordained on election night 2016?
Yeah, maybe so. Really, it came out of a national effort called Writers Resist, which was originally begun by the writer Aaron Ballou and in conjunction with Pen America in New York. Writers Resist took place on January 15th, 2017, so just before the inauguration. And it brought together writers, some of America's finest writers in cities and towns across the country to protest, right? And so what do writers do when we protest? Well, we write things, but we also call upon the spirits of writers who have come before us. And in Philadelphia, we think there were more than 300 of these events around the country. In Philadelphia, Stephanie and I and Alicia Askenaze, who is a poet, we organized Writers Resist, and luckily for us, the event took place right on Independence Mall. So literally where the protest texts of the formation of America took place, and we drew on that spirit in creating that event. And it was really an incredibly moving experience to bring together contemporary writers, assign them each some kind of legacy piece, a speech, a poem, a document, a section of a novel, a piece of polemic, whatever it was from a vast, diverse array of American protest literature, and to hear it read out loud was really, really moving. So, for example, one of our readers read Pier Paolo Pasolini's poem, The Resistance, and Its Light, which begins, "So I came to the days of the resistance." So hear that in a crowd of hundreds of people, you start to feel something. We read Allen Ginsberg's poem called Friday the 13th, and in that poem there's a line in which he asks, "What can poetry do?" And so we created this thing where writers gave themselves a voice by drawing on the voices of writers in the past, and that's how this book came to be. We realized the emotional impact of it and also the potential of writers coming together to think about the situation we're in, to reflect on it personally, and in for ourselves and our families and our communities, and to then examine and interrogate the nation that we have become, the nation that elected Donald Trump, and in various forms, from the essay form to science fiction to poetry, we imagine the future. The title of Who Will Speak for America comes from one of our readings during Writers Resist on January 15th, 2017, and it comes from a speech by Barbara Jordan, Congresswoman Barbara Jordan, who was speaking in the summer of 1976. She was the first black female to speak in front of the Democratic National Convention, and she posed that question in her speech, "Who will speak for America?" And so we draw upon her words and ask contemporary writers, about 40 of them, what we did was essentially ask them to respond to her question. And they submitted poetry, they submitted essays, they submitted polemic, they submitted cartoons, They submitted short fiction pieces, a lot of imaginative work.
Now, this will come up again, I'm sure, but you say you did not just want rebuttal and condemnation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the it's very easy to be angry. And it's very, and of course, many of us are feeling an extraordinary sort of tide or wave of anger right now, right around the issue that's happening at the Texas border, which is, you know, just one small example of how, of the nativism of the current administration and how it's playing out in real time. But there was no sense in just being angry. There was no sense in condemning. The writer's instinct is to try to understand, is to reflect, is to observe and document. We have some of that in our book. And then the other writer's instinct, aside from those things, is to use words to imagine, use words to envision. And really what we did in the founding of this country was use words to create. And we're trying to do a little bit of that with this book.
The book is called Who Will Speak for America? The work of 40-some-odd writers, some in prose, some in poetry, some in cartoon. And we'll come back and talk more with the co-editor, Nathaniel Popkin, editing with Stephanie Feldman. It's a really broad project with lots to talk about yet ahead. You can join the conversation by phone or email. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Nathaniel Popkin and you in a minute 20. There's a very comprehensive introduction by you and Stephanie together, and you wrote about the Obama years in here, and I'm trying to understand what it was you were talking about. There was essentially a resistance to a resistance there.
Oh, when we reference the Obama years, I know very specifically one thing we say is that the Obama years brought a lot of progress. You know. Barack Obama was a moderate as a president, and he was a centrist in many ways, and that frustrated a lot of people on the left and then a lot of liberals as well, because he sought to govern from the center. And he sought to govern, I think, in a uniquely as a biracial person for representing the whole country. Nevertheless, his political instincts, his humanitarian instincts are mostly quite liberal, and in fact there was a good bit of progress on lots of issues in the United States during his two administrations. I mean, first of all, he recovered the economy from the Great Recession. Incarceration rates have begun to fall. There were legal gains for queer and transgender people, of course, a steep decline in uninsured people, and it goes on and on, actually. Unemployment went down considerably. You know, the gains were quite good. America reasserted its role as a leader in terms of human rights, in terms of multilateralism, and there were some real, I think, kind of extraordinary results of all of that. And so at the same time, what's interesting that happens with our book is that our writers don't just say everything went down when Donald Trump was elected. They're examining the various reasons, the various systems that that the U.S. Exists under that led to the election of Donald Trump, and some of them are systemic racism. Renee Denfeld, who is an Oregon resident, and she is a great example of a contributor to our book. So she's a novelist, really well-recognized novelist, who also represents incarcerated people, who particularly those on death row. And in that sense, she's an activist. Working through the system day after day with people to work for justice on their behalf. Well, she has observed this really deeply unjust incarceration system for many years before Trump became president. And so her critique is long-lasting. And she makes a really interesting observation in her essay in our book, which is to say that the election of Trump came not just out of a kind of split country, but because it almost was a result or a product of incarceration. So you have a tremendous amount of African Americans incarcerated. So they're actually taken out of the electoral system in some states. But the over-incarceration of white people also has an effect, and she says it radicalizes white men, particularly in jail. And that ideology of radicalization of white people has led to white supremacy as well.
Well, we were talking to Nathaniel Popkin about the book Who Will Speak for America, the work of some 40 writers in poetry, in prose, and in cartoon about the resistance, basically, in print. So the basic question that I'm sure a lot of people are going to come down to, which is the inevitable charges that range from you're not giving Trump a chance to you're committing treason, and I wonder what the general response is there.
Oh, well, I haven't heard either of those as critiques to this. I mean, I think one thing that's interesting is that people have been willing to give the administration a chance in many ways, and they've demonstrated over and over again that they don't deserve it. You have probably the most corrupt administration in our lifetime. Demonstrably corrupt officials. You have a president who doesn't claim to be the president for everyone. Even in a tweet yesterday, "I represent the deplorables," he said. Actually, it wasn't in a tweet. It was quoting a speech that he gave yesterday. Mm-hmm. So, and that's a code word for a specific set of people who he would like to imagine are Americans. And one thing that we see with this book is, and that this book responds to, I think, is an attempt by many people in this administration, very powerful people like Bannon, Steve Bannon, or Steve Miller, and the president himself, to align the noun American with white native-born people. And a lot of the writers in our book, including the novelist Samira Ahmed, who has just written a best-selling YA novel, Ganzir, who is now living in Denver. He came to America as a refugee from Egypt because his writing and his art challenged the dictatorship of Egypt, and his life was under threat, and so he was able to get asylum in America. Moya Kaff, Anna Maureen Lara, Cynthia Oka, who came to Canada and lived in Vancouver as a refugee from Indonesia as a child and writes about the pain of learning to become American. She now lives in the United States, and so on. Carlos Perez Samano, who is a recent immigrant from Mexico, and is a writer, and he's grappling with what it means to be an American in a different sense from what it meant to be an American living in Mexico, because, of course, Mexicans live in North America as well. So this is a long way of saying that the writers in our anthology are grappling with, and not in a pedantic kind of way, but in a thoughtful and reflective way on what it means for them, many of them immigrants, to think of themselves as American, in truly stark contrast to, I think, the way this administration thinks of who is an American and who is not. It's important for us to remember that we really are, it's being demonstrated this week, in a nativist moment. And we've had these moments in our history, and here we are again.
And, you know, as the book, there's an undercurrent in the book about pointing out that we do still share some values. You know, there are lots of things we do carry in common, aside from the things that we choose to identify that divide us.
I think that's really important. In our writers and in our introduction, in fact, we pose the question about what it means to talk from the point of view of a single identity. And, you know, I do think that we as human beings do identify in certain ways. And those those identities are more pronounced now, whether they're a queer identity or people of color identity or white male identity. You know, these things are being more pronounced, and it gives us a sense that we're dividing ourselves, mm-hmm. like we're purposely dividing ourselves.
The identity politics, as often said by Republicans.
Exactly, and in fact, Liana Fink, who is a New Yorker cartoonist and a graphic novelist, a young woman who lives in New York, she has, I think, 5 cartoons in our book. One of them is called Identity Politics, and it says, you know, on one side she writes identity politics, and on the other side, you know, what's not identity politics according to conservative white Americans? It's actually white male identity politics. They just think that's everything else, right? Like that's non-identity politics. But in fact, people are always talking from a certain point of view. Our writers, I think, really are searching for common ground. Barbara Jordan was searching for common ground. She wanted to believe that Americans could come together in unity, and this was after Watergate and after Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Our writers are truly seeking a way to talk about shared things. And in some sense, some of that shared sense is from subjugation or from terror or, you know, being the recipients of. So Jericho Brown, who's one of our great American poets of our day, is writing about violence perpetrated against black men by police officers. And Cynthia Atkins, a white American poet, is writing about sexual abuse. And so you can then see a common ground there about being not necessarily a victim, but by being subjugated. And then your voice grows through that. But I think that most of the writers in our book aren't thinking about themselves as victims. They're thinking about themselves as Americans, and their concept of Americanness is really rich and almost infinite and limitless, and it doesn't want to be limited by a certain set of criteria.
Yeah, and I want to point out, this is not just a book where every single page is a rant about Trump. It's a lot of self-examination, too, about, you know, the lives of the people who are doing the writing and the ways in which they respond to each other in America today, and not just about things that go on in Washington. The collection is called Who Will Speak for America, co-edited by Stephanie Feldman and Nathaniel Popkin. Nathaniel's our guest on The Exchange. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jeffnet.org. A couple of calls here, first from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. There you are. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, there I am. I finally have a signal again.
Ah.
I have a double-pronged question, and if based in Barbara Jordan's Who Will Speak for America, the first, imagine it two-dimensional, who will speak for the many layers of America that are not poets, that are in fact looking for their voice, because they don't have a voice. They are, their voice is not as pronounced, not as specific, not as eloquent.
Mm-hmm.
They are actually the ones looking for the voice. They are not the quote voice professionals. The other side of the same thing is that I would like to look at the larger picture. Like if you look at Trump as the boil, where's the disease? And the disease is worldwide. Now we have a nationalistic wave covering the globe, you know, and mm-hmm. borders get closed, ships get rejected in the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
That is who will speak for those people who will actually then point to, quote, us, close quote, as causing, by way of natural resource interests, lots of poverty, lots of dictatorial interests all over the world. So both ends, you know, not just some kind of umbilicus picking type of American points of view of a certain range of people who are very eloquent.
All right.
What I'm saying?
Yeah, all right.
Both sides.
Okay, thank you for that, Wolfgang. And so let me take this in reverse order, because particularly in the reference to issues going on all over the world, the rise of nationalism outside of our borders, is that addressed at all in the collection, Nathaniel?
I don't think it's... first of all, Wolfgang's questions were excellent, and the points he's making really are important. We are experiencing a nationalistic moment around the world, and we're seeing it in places like Italy and Poland and Hungary and beyond, right? Well beyond. It's interesting what happens, I think. One of the great roles of the United States, and it's a subtle thing, is that... we present a kind of attitude. And so if the United States joins the Paris Treaty on Global Warming, if the United States professes, even if the CIA undermines it, which it does all the time, professes to uphold human rights, if the United States raises, even though the number is never adequate, the number of refugees that are allowed in because 65 million people around the world are displaced, if we do these things, if we're part of the UN Human Rights Commission, which we are no longer, we are sending a subtle message about what's okay and what's not okay. That message has been completely eviscerated by Donald Trump, who says it's okay to speak hate. And so he's actually encouraging the spreading of nationalism, which suits his political interests, obviously, and opening in this country and beyond a Pandora's box of hate. And there's no question that, I mean, it's been traced, it's factually provable that his candidacy and his election engendered more political violence, more hate speak, and more acts against those who are underrepresented in this country than had been going on in the years previous.
So then, as Wolfgang asked in the other part of his question, I mean, how do
exactly.
the people who are underrepresented get a voice?
Well, it's interesting, and I think, you know, we're in an interesting moment in the United States. As a writer, I can speak to this, right? It seems like not many people read, as you know, like books and literature are no longer so central to the life of the country, if they ever were in a European sense. And in countries around the world, I think that literature and literary figures have a much bigger role in the life of the nation than they do in the United States. Most of us don't know who our great literary figures of the day are. However, writers have a unique role in our society, which is a society of self-invention and self-governance, and that is to give voice to those who don't have one. And one of the greatest things about this collection, Who Will Speak for America, is that we attempt to give voice to those who are severely underrepresented, and not only give them voice, but to give people a way to attach to powerful words that can help empower them in their own lives.
We will talk about some of the material more specifically in just a few moments here on the Jefferson Exchange. The collection is called Who Will Speak for America? 40 different people expressing themselves in prose, in poetry, in cartoon. Nathaniel Popkin and Stephanie Feldman, the co-editors, will come back and talk more with Nathaniel and take more phone calls from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Is it okay to read just a little bit of Joy Ladin's America in Winter poem?
Do you want me to read it?
I wanted to just get this section in the middle. Every now and then I tell myself she's catching my eye. It's a couple of stanzas there.
Okay. Right. Every now and then?
Yes. So those three stanzas there, yeah.
All right. Every now and then I tell myself she's catching my eye, dreaming, like me, of growing old together, if we both survive. She's the only country I've ever wanted, the only one who could finish my sentences. God, she's beautiful without her clothes. When we were 50 years younger, we walked on the moon together.
And that's just a central portion of America in Winter by Joy Ladin. It's very moving stuff. And so, you know, I want to make it clear that again, that this is not just an anti-Trump rant, but this is a book with a lot of people thinking deeply about the America that they love deeply.
Exactly true. I mean, we spend the first subpart, I guess, you know, the first chapter of the book, several people reflect on the immediate post-election feeling. And some people might not want to revisit that or want to move on from it or don't think it's so important to reflect on. But, for example, the author Melissa Phoebos writes about how she had to adjust her teaching. She teaches a creative writing at a university on the East Coast, and her students in the post-election moment, some of whom voted for Trump, whose family supported Trump, they came in the next day and in the next weeks kind of beside themselves and flummoxed, and some of them sad, some of them sobbing. And Melissa writes about how she tried through teaching to get her students to think together.
This is an amazing story. She talks about going to school that day and not knowing what she was going to say.
Exactly, and she, as many great teachers are capable of doing, are able to come up with an answer on the spot, right? And so she figured out how to do it, which was to ask her students to imagine the elements of the country as they would want to see it. And then when you ask people that and you forget about ideology and you forget about class and you forget about the labels that we all live under day by day, and you just ask people to envision the kind of country that they want, the things they want, what they want for themselves and their families, all of a sudden the picture that gets painted is very unifying, right? We all want to thrive. We all want to feel comfortable in our communities. We all want a clean environment. We all want to, when we go to school, feel safe and not threatened that someone's going to come in and shoot us up. And if we start to imagine a politics based on that, and this is what writers do because they write down visions,
mm-hmm.
then we can maybe build and move on.
You know, the idea that that the disagreements are in the family, and sometimes literally so. Sarah Rose Eder is one of the writers who gets right there. She talks to her dad in a short, prosy kind of poem about the situation. And I have to wonder, though, for you, Nathaniel, though, as an editor with a hard eye for people's writing, did much of this move you personally?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the book is just coming out now, and we're beginning to talk about it for the first time publicly. We're doing so during this week. It's a very painful week where American ideals are being punished front and center, right? Like incarcerating children, separating them from families, incarcerating people with below minor violations who happen to be immigrants, even though we're a country based on immigrants, my own family, almost everyone else's family, and it's a painful time. And so this stuff is really personal. Joy's poem that you asked me to read from, exceptionally moving. And other people's, Moya Kopf's poem in there, Cynthia Oka's poem about being a refugee from Indonesia. Then there's also, though, you know, so as an, you asked me to think about this as an editor. Well, this is an anthology, right? So it's the work of 40 writers or so, and it, yet it needs to hold together. And so what we really tried to do was give it a narrative, starting with the election, starting with the reflection as it affected writers personally and their families. There's a lot of, in, you know, on election night 2017 or 2016, the years are getting away, our family, we were at a neighbor's house watching the returns. It became clear what was happening. My daughter and I left. She was 16 at the time. We walked out to the street. She started crying. We came home. It became the New York Times meter. It became very clear what was happening. Very painful to see that data. And I held her, a 16-year-old girl, sobbing for an hour. And she wasn't sobbing because one man won and one woman lost. She wasn't sobbing because a Republican won and a Democrat lost. She was sobbing because a known sexual predator was now the president of the United States. And she felt it as a young woman exceptionally personally. And it was an incredible thing. I never would have, we always say, like, politics is personal, right? Or politics would be better if it was more personal. Well, in this situation, right, because you would act more. In this situation, it was almost overwhelming. Bassi Ikpi, who's a writer, she writes about observing her son and her father, a Nigerian immigrant, who had been an early backer of Barack Obama's candidacy, and really she talks about how much her father had fallen in love with Obama. And then she and her father had some, you know, tough times personally. And then the election happens, and her son is now 10 or so, and what she's now watching is her son and her father bonding over this very difficult moment of, you know, Obama being erased,
yeah,
which is what Trump is trying to do, and so this is a personal thing. At the same time, we tried to create a narrative in the book that would take the reader from that immediate reaction period, and so we talk about people speaking for ourselves, for our families, or to ourselves and to our families, and we think about how writers then take on the voice of the country. And so the second part of the book is for our country.
Right. It goes from speaking to America to speaking for America. Yeah.
It's exactly. And that's a lifting up. And it's not all positive. Some of it's difficult and dark. Some writers imagine the dissolution. Malka Older, who's a science fiction writer, imagines the dissolution of the nation. Charlie Jane Anders, who is a Bay Area resident and a science fiction writer, imagines a kind of a dystopic future for North America. But we also have Veronica Scott Esposito, a Oakland resident.
She's a convert, I notice.
Yeah, so Veronica grew up in Southern California in a Republican family, voting, you know, wishing well, was too young to vote, but wishing well for the, I forget the prop number that passed, the anti-immigration proposition that passed. And as she got older as a teenager, getting more involved, reading some of the Federalist Papers and some of the early documents of the founding of the country, and that opened up her mind to thinking much more widely about the meaning of America and became a convert. And her argument, in a very clearly argued essay at the end of our book, is don't give up hope. Imagine the ways in which California has transformed its politics and now is the number one place for both immigrants from outside of the country and domestic migrants. You know, people move to California. It's a magnet because it does so many things right.
That was Prop 187 in 1994. I had to go back and check the number myself.
Yep.
And so things have changed quite a bit. Let's take some calls here. Ann in Eugene, welcome to The Exchange with Nathaniel Popkin, the co-editor of Who Will Speak for America.
Thank you. So the basic thoughts of the Republican hierarchy, the leadership, is that society exists to support the privileged. And so they use racism, sexism, homophobia, gerrymandering, voter suppression, in order to meet the needs of those billionaires that support them. And there is a lot of racism, sexism, homophobia, anti-intellectualism in this country. And the only bright thing that I can think of is perhaps that the election of Trump will wake people up. And we only had 57% of eligible voters vote in the 2016 election. And if another percentage or so had voted for Hillary Clinton, she would have won. So, you know, this wake-up call of seeing our country go down the wrong road, seeing the horrendous things that the Trump administration is doing, we'll see if voters in this fall will wake up and see what's going on to their country. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate that. So Nathaniel, does the book serve any sort of overt political purpose? Is it meant just as art, or is it also meant to inspire people to action?
I think it's not. It doesn't have an overt political purpose. I mean, I certainly there is a clear line that runs through the book, and Veronica's essay towards the end is a really good example. I mean, as it does exhort us to act, and other writers are reflecting on what's happened, reflecting on their own history, and helping us to imagine a different nation in a different world that might be possible America. And so it is a call to action, and I think what the caller was saying was something that a lot of us are hoping could possibly be true, that the extreme right turn that we have taken as a nation is stark. And the resistance that has followed the election of Donald Trump is not a minor thing. It's actually growing. It's actually had a lot of success, though the Democratic Party is sort of almost powerless by not controlling and having very few levers of political power over any of the branches of the federal government. But the resistance is growing, and it is working in lots of ways.
At the same time, though, we have Republicans who represent Trump or approve of Trump at a rate higher than Ronald Reagan did at this point in his term. And as you point out in the intro, Donald Trump has kept a lot of his promises.
And it's true. And so we're going to see to what extent, you know, that solid core of his support, you know, how what size of the electorate that is, we don't know. I would say that Donald Trump has been aided by an extraordinary complicitness on the part of congressional Republicans who have been utterly unwilling to stand up to him unless you're retiring, you don't stand up to him.
Right. There's a whole lot to unpack, both in the country and in the book. Yeah. The book is called Who Will Speak for America, edited by Stephanie Feldman and Nathaniel Popkin. Nathaniel's been our guest. He'll be in San Francisco at City Lights Bookstore next Wednesday, June 27th, and in Portland at Powell's on August 8th. Thank you so much for joining us today, Nathaniel.
Thank you, Jeffrey.